Hello, and welcome to the recording of the Waterloo Cedar Falls The Courier for Wednesday, August 19th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. Today, the newspaper is predicting a humid day with a high of 83 and a low of 58 tonight. In our first article this morning, on the front page, criticism of Griffin as racist disputed. Waterloo. The Griffin on the police department's patch came under fire during Monday's city council meeting as a local attorney called the creature a racist symbol. And this article opens with a photograph of the police patch showing a red griffin in the middle, and says Waterloo Police across the top of the crest, and at the bottom it says vigilance. Controversy over the symbol has been simmering in recent months, with some calling for its removal and police officers standing by it. During Monday's public comment section, Catherine Mahoney, a private attorney, said the creature on the patch, a red griffin on a gold field, adopted around the time of the civil rights struggles, resembles an image associated with the Ku Klux Klan. Quote, "We must remove the symbol and adopt something we can all be proud of. It so closely resembles Klan Dragon that the two symbols are fairly indistinguishable," Mahoney said. Quote, "Many states incorporated the stars and bars into their state flags in the 1960s. Waterloo adopted the Klan Dragon," she said. Police officers said the griffin, part eagle, part lion, from Greek and Egyptian mythology, represents vigilance. The logo on the patch was the work of Jack Bender, a one-time cartoonist for The Courier, best known for inheriting the Alley-Oop comic strip. The image is emblazoned on uniform shoulder patches and on squad car doors. Critics of the police patch said the rendering looks more like a dragon, which has ties to the KKK. A Klan state chapter president is called a Grand Dragon, and the hate group borrows other fantasy beasts for offices, hydras, wizards, giants, and cyclopses. No griffins. Major Quentin Hart, appearing at Monday's video meeting, stepped in during Mahoney's statement. Quote, "Miss Mahoney, no one from the police department has ever said it was a Klan Dragon. It is defined as a griffin. Whether it looks like it or not, that's the subject to debate. No one said it was a Klan Dragon within these city walls," Hart said. Quote, "Relatives of officers have publicly stated it was well known as a, quote, green-eyed N-word eater," Mahoney responded. "It was prejudicial against our police officers. There is no career in the world that doesn't have an occasional bad apple, but you don't lump everyone together and you don't call into question the noble service of many police officers present and past," Klein said. Council member Pat Morrissey came to Mahoney's defense, saying she was making a statement about basic human rights. Quote, "The citizen who spoke was making a statement to the continued mistreatment, abuse of a segment of 15 to 20% of our city, and how a certain logo is oppressive to that citizenry," Morrison said, noting he would support a resolution to do away with the griffin. The griffin patch has come under renewed criticism this year during Black Lives Matter protests, and the city's new police chief has floated the idea of taking up a second patch, one designed by community members, while still retaining the griffin patch. The city's police union, the Waterloo Police Protective Association, is against removing the griffin and is urging residents to contact city council members and the mayor to support the logo. Quote, "Waterloo Police Department officers have proudly worn this griffin for 56 years while humbly serving the citizens of Waterloo," said Rob Camerata, a police sergeant. "The griffin has been part of the Waterloo Police Department uniform since 1964, after the police chief at that time, Robert Wright, conducted research on the patch in an effort to find a unique patch that would be symbolic of police work. After controversy over the griffin image started, the Anti-Defamation League, a nonprofit that monitors hate groups, was contacted to look for any possible links, he said. Quote, the Anti-Defamation League reported back that there are no ties between the Griffin and any hate groups, Camarada said. Alternative patch designs can be submitted to patchdesign@waterloopolice.com. The deadline is August 31st. Some of the suggestions are posted on the Waterloo Police Department's Facebook page and include images of the Sullivan brothers, the 4th Street Bridge, and clasped hands with the motto, Bridging the Gap. Mayors press Trump to act on aid for homeowners, filed by James Lynch of the Courier Des Moines Bureau. And it opens with a picture of the president sitting at a table behind the presidential seal. And the caption is, President Donald Trump listens during a briefing on derecho damage and recovery efforts Tuesday in Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids. As mayors and residents pleaded for aid to storm-ravaged individuals, President Donald Trump repeatedly reassured Iowans on Tuesday more help will be coming. Thousands of homes and millions of acres of crops were damaged when hurricane force winds ripped across the state more than a week ago, carving a $4 billion path of destruction. We'll take care of it, the president said multiple times during the half-hour discussion in response to entreaties from mayors of Cedar Rapids and Marion, communities at the epicenter of the damage. Quote, we're getting it taken care of and done very quickly, said Trump. On Monday, the president signed Governor Kim Reynolds' request for a major disaster declaration. However, according to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Trump's declaration covered only the public assistance portion of Reynolds' request, about $45 million for debris removal and repair to government buildings and utilities in 16 counties. Her request for $82.7 million to help those whose homes were destroyed or badly damaged was not included. FEMA says it is still under review. Also not yet approved is the $3.77 billion for estimated agricultural damage to farmland, grain bins, and buildings, and $100 million for private utilities repair. According to Iowa Homeland Security, the agriculture and private utility funding wouldn't come under the auspices of FEMA. Iowans need the individual assistance from FEMA, Cedar Rapids Mayor Brad Hart told Trump during the president's brief stop at the Eastern Iowa airport. The individual assistance is really important because almost every one of the community's 60,000 homes and businesses was damaged. Homeowners insurance, for those who have it, won't cover many of the expenses, including tree removal, Hart said. That could be tens of thousands of dollars, he said. So adding the individual assistance component to the disaster declaration would really help us so many people get those trees out of their yard and not have such a financial burden. Quote, we'll take care of that, unquote, Trump said. Reynolds assured the mayor the state is gathering the numbers needed to expand the declaration. Quote, we'll be able to add that on, and we should be able to do that in a short amount of time, she said. Marion Mayor Nicholas Abu Asli estimated 90% to 95% of all homes and businesses in his city have some damage. Quote, the scale of this disaster will be devastating, Abu Asli warned. Okay, we're working on it, Trump said. It's a double whammy. The devastation of the derecho is taking a human toll, added Kim Ren, executive director of Mission of Hope in Cedar Rapids. The faith-based organization works with people in need, including those who are homeless. Quote, and this week, I became one of them, she said. Although confident her family will recover, Rem said others are not as fortunate and need federal assistance. Quote, their physical needs are not being met, Rem said, about the people of Mission of Hope is feeding. Many of them have lost their shelter. They don't know where their clothes are. Quote, we're strong, Rem said, echoing other speakers. We're strong and we're resilient, Mr. President, but we're tired and we need your help. Trump also heard from U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, who the president described as an incredible man, and Agricultural Secretary Mike Nagy about the impact on farms. About 113 million acres of crops have been damaged or destroyed, Grassley said. Nagy told Trump, Central and East Central Iowa cooperatives are reporting early estimates of more than 57 million bushels of grain storage capacity seriously damaged or destroyed. The co-ops estimate it will cost more than $300 million to remove, replace, or repair damaged bins. In light of the damage done to the ethanol industry, first as COVID-19 reduced Americans' travel, and now by the wind damage to cornfields, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst told Trump he should not allow any waivers from the renewable fuel standard. Quote, just dispense of those, she said. We just need help from the EPA to follow the intent of the law, unquote. Quote, we'll speak to them, Trump said. We'll speak to them. State Representative Ashley Hinson, Republican of Marion, stressed the importance of repairing schools that suffered damage, catastrophic damage in many cases, similar to a hurricane. Well, we'll take care of it, and you will make a fast recovery, Trump said. Hinson is challenging Democratic 1st District Representative Abby Finkenauer, who was not invited to the event. Finkenauer, who has been critical of Reynolds' efforts, spoke Monday to presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden and Finkenauer had a brief conversation during which she asked him to, quote, use his national platform to draw attention to the crisis in Iowa. Her campaign said in a statement, she looks forward to engaging with anyone and everyone to bring much-needed resources to our state. Trump noted he is familiar with many of the counties devastated by the derecho from campaigning here in 2016. Quote, this has been a very loving area, unquote. A different tune, COVID-19 transforms high school marching, even keeping some bands off the field. This filed by Andrew Wind. Waterloo. The East High School band students were spread across the field in lines, standing up straight and holding their instruments out in front of them. Quote, you're always at attention, heels together, said director Jolie Smith from her perch on the raised platform. As a simple cadence was played on a single snare drum, she instructed students about raising their instruments to their lips altogether. Quote, make sure it pops, really pops up, she said. Monday was the final day of a band camp that looked a little different than past years, thanks to precautions intended to keep COVID-19 from spreading. Students began camp during the first week of August, starting with drumline. Later in the week, groups of 15 to 20 students started coming for sectional practice, either in the morning or afternoon. They were meeting together as the full band for the first time Monday, with no plans to work on marching routine. Today is all about the music and playing together, said Smith. At East's home games this fall, students will march onto the field and form the lines, but then remain stationary while performing their three songs. East and other Cedar Valley bands will not compete this fall in marching contests, which are largely canceled. West High School's band won't be even marching onto the field. Instead, students will play pep band music from the stands at Waterloo Memorial Stadium. The school also wrapped up its two-week band camp Monday, which similarly featured shorter practice sessions with smaller groups. Cedar Falls High School did not hold its camp and isn't doing any kind of marching this fall, opting instead to move right to concert band. In contrast to the others, Don Bosco High School in Gilbertville held a full band camp to prepare a themed marching show that students will perform on the field at home football games. At East, 43 students were on the field practicing Monday. Smith said about 50 of her more than 60 students largely attended the camp. She expects to be able to help those who didn't attend to catch up once school starts, since students will be divided into two groups, alternating days. The band also doesn't include students who are starting the year attending school online and from home. Senior Isaiah Thompson, a flute player, said focusing all of their attention on music without the marching emphasis had meant students are learning the songs faster. "It has been better than the last 2 years," she said. "The only thing that's changed is the time commitment and the marching." "Without the marching, we have less to worry about," admitted Jada Thurnau, another senior flute player. But she missed the opportunity from past years for the entire band to practice together. "It's a lot different than last year," she said. "I don't think it's as fun." "There were a lot more rules, kind of," noted Nick Peterson, a senior trombone player. "There's the mask. There's not everybody being here every day. And it's not as long." At West High, Danny Kleinheitz, co-director of West's band, said they decided against marching this fall for a number of reasons. Among those were the challenges of social distancing and concerns with stepping onto the field after football players had been playing in the same space. In addition, all but one of the competitions the band usually attends have been canceled. "There's nowhere to perform it," he said, "of putting together a marching routine. We didn't want the kids to do all that work and not show it off anywhere." He expects about 120 students in what is usually marching band this fall, plus another 20 in the ninth grade band. They were placed in the band after opting not to march during their freshman year. Others who are learning from home this fall aren't currently part of the band, but, quote, "we want to make sure we're offering those students something," said Kleinheitz. "So when they do come back, they'll be able to play in the band." Both the East and West bands will have class outside as much as possible this fall. When they need to go inside at West, students will meet in the auditorium, where each will have a different assigned seat. Each student will also have an assigned music stand to help reduce the possibility of contaminating equipment. Cedar Falls. Kyle Engelhart, co-director of Cedar Falls Band, said, quote, "We're planning to start indoors in small ensembles. We're scheduling that way basically because the smaller groups are easier for us to handle logistically." Starting the year with concert instead of marching band came down to a lot of the moving pieces, he said. "We didn't have a way to safely get 166 kids onto the field. Home games are at the Unidome," he noted, "and directors didn't have an efficient way to mitigate for the indoor environment." Quote, "We've split our group," he explained, "to reduce the number of students in one place. We'll have three approximately 40-person bands," unquote. Another 35 are learning online from home. They will receive music lessons over the internet from teachers. In addition, they will collaborate with other students in virtual ensembles using new technology available for such purposes. Don Bosco's band held a week-long camp at the beginning of August. Quote, "We did our best to put social distancing and safety measures in action during the camp," said director Myron Makita. "We worked on marching fundamentals and our new show music." The band will be putting its show for the frontline heroes on the field this fall, honoring professionals like medical workers, emergency responders, and educators. Much of the music chosen by students comes from superhero movies including Superman, The Avengers, and The Incredibles. Makita also included Fanfare for the Common Man by American composer Aaron Copland. During the show, individuals in some of the highlighted professions will be brought onto the field, escorted by students dressed as superheroes. Postmaster suspends mail changes amid uproar, filed by the Associated Press. The picture that opens the story shows a man loading a huge Amazon box into the back of his postal truck. Washington. Facing mounting public pressure and a crush of state lawsuits, President Donald Trump's new Postmaster General announced Tuesday he will halt some operational changes to mail delivery that critics blamed for widespread delays and warned could disrupt November election. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy said he would suspend several of his initiatives, including the removal of the distinctive blue mailboxes that prompted an outcry, until after the election, quote, to avoid even the appearance of impact on election mail, unquote. Quote, we will deliver the nation's election mail on time, DeJoy said in a statement. The abrupt reversal from DeJoy, who is scheduled to testify Friday before the Senate, comes as more than 20 states, from New York to California, announced they would sue to stop the changes. Several vowed to press on, keeping a watchful eye on the Postal Service ahead of the election. Speaker Nancy Pelosi pushed ahead with Saturday's vote to prevent election year mail changes and provide emergency postal funds. Quote, I don't, frankly, trust the Postmaster General, Pelosi said in San Francisco. The crisis at the Postal Service erupted as a major election year issue as DeJoy, a Republican donor who took control of the agency in June, swiftly engineered cuts and operational changes that disrupted mail delivery operations and raised alarms that Trump is trying to undermine the agency ahead of the election. At the White House, Trump flatly denied he is seeking to slow walk the mail, even as he leveled fresh assaults Tuesday on mail-in voting and universal ballots. More Americans than ever are expected to choose to vote absentee during the coronavirus outbreak. In fact, as of Monday, more than 2.1 million people cast mail-in ballots in Trump's home state of Florida, with more still coming in. That compares to fewer than 1.3 million in the 2016 primary. Unlike 2016, when there were primaries for U.S. Senate that helped drive up turnout, there are no statewide races on the August 2020 ballot. Mail-in ballots have to be received by 7 p.m. Tuesday to be counted. Quote, you can't have millions and millions of ballots sent all over the place, sent to people that are dead, sent to dogs, cats, sent everywhere, Trump told reporters. This isn't games, and you have to get it right, unquote. With the Trump administration openly trying to undermine mail-in voting, some election officials around the country hope to bypass the Postal Service by installing lots of ballot drop boxes in libraries, community centers, and other public places. Such boxes have been used with success for several years in states like Oregon, Washington, and Colorado that rely largely or entirely on ballots that must be sent in. Their use is being expanded because of the coronavirus outbreak and, more recently, concerns about the post office's ability to do its job. State or local authorities in places such as Arizona, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania pressed for more boxes or drop-off sites that would enable ballots to reach election officials without going through the mail. Some of the initiatives DeJoy said he would shelve until after the election already were announced. DeJoy said Tuesday he will halt the planned removal of mail processing machines and blue collection boxes, as well as an initiative to change retail hours at post offices. He also said that no mail processing facilities will be closed, and said the agency has not eliminated overtime. What's going on right now is nothing less than a full-on assault by this administration on the U.S. Postal Service, an institution that millions of Americans rely on every single day, said Bob Ferguson, the Attorney General in Washington State, at a news conference. Ferguson and Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro announced they were leading collections of other states in suing to block service changes at the Postal Service, just as the postmaster was making his own statement Tuesday. Both Shapiro and Ferguson said they would not take DeJoy at his word. Quote, we need to see binding action to reverse these changes, Shapiro said. Trump made clear last week he will block $25 billion in emergency aid to the Postal Service, acknowledging he wanted to curtail election mail operations, as well as a Democratic proposal to provide $3.6 billion in additional election money to the states to help process an expected surge of mail-in ballots. Pelosi is gaining GOP support for Saturday's vote, according to two Republican aides granted anonymity to discuss the situation. She called lawmakers back to Washington for the, quote, Delivering for America Act, which would prohibit the Postal Service from implementing any changes to operations or level of service it had in place on January 1st. The package would include the $25 billion approved as part of the COVID-19 rescue that is stalled in the Senate. Turning now to the Cedar Valley page, Cedar Falls Columbus High Schools received grants for CAPS program. Cedar Falls. Two school systems are each receiving $25,000 state grants to continue and expand their STEM-focused career education programs. Cedar Falls Community Schools and Cedar Valley Catholic Schools in Waterloo both received the award recently from the Governor's Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics Advisory Council. They were among 12 STEM Best grants awarded by the council based at the University of Northern Iowa. Both school systems will use the funds for their Center for Advanced Professional Studies programs. Awards can go out toward curriculum development and coordination, educator training and development in workspace, workplace classroom integration, and preparing the learning environment. Ethan Weichman, director of Cedar Falls High School program, said the grant will go towards new industries and certified nursing assistant strands. CAPS began at the high school in January 2017 and currently has four other program strands. In the last few years, Cedar Falls has helped expand CAPS to other area school systems, including CVCS. Habitat for Humanity will be among the business partners for Cedar Falls Industries Program. CAPS student associates will learn technical skills and be exposed to multiple construction and trades fields while giving back to their community and helping building habitat homes in Cedar Valley, noted Weichman. The CNA, Certified Nursing Assistant Program, will partner with Western Homes Communities, which will provide an instructor and space for students to meet. Quote, part of the requirement of the grant is to have some contribution or match from local organizations or businesses or workplace partners, said Lindy Eibling, communications manager with the STEM Council. A Cedar Valley Catholic Schools spokeswoman said the funds will be used to support the CAPS program at Columbus High School. Eibling said the school system has indicated it was applying to basically continue their involvement in the CAPS network for a second year. Programs receiving grants through the STEM Best, or Business Engineering Students and Teachers, help students gain authentic workplace experience and develop greater knowledge of skills in fields such as advanced manufacturing, agriculture, and healthcare. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Wednesday, August 19th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Pauline Shreve, 98, of Cedar Falls, passed away at her home on Saturday, August 8, 2020, surrounded by her beloved daughters. She was born in Adams, Minnesota on July 5, 1922, the daughter of John and Theodora Knutson. Pauline's family moved to Cedar Falls, where she graduated from the Teachers College High School with the class of 1940, then attended the Iowa State Teachers College, graduating in 1942. she accepted her first position as a first grade teacher in the Dumont schools, where she worked for 9 years. She was married to Burl Bud Shreve on August 29, 1948, at the First Congregational Church of Cedar Falls. They moved to Cedar Falls in 1951, where Pauline worked for several years before starting her favorite and most important calling as a mother and housewife. Pauline's family held a private graveside service at Fairview Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Cedar Valley Hospice, and condolences may be left at www.dollfuneralhome.com. Pauline loved to do handwork, read, work crossword puzzles, and play solitaire on her iPad. She was a great cook and made intricate Christmas cookies and carried on Norwegian family traditions such as coffee lunch. Most of all, Pauline loved to spend time with her family. Dale Fensel, 68, of Gladbrook, formerly of Waterloo, died Friday, August 14th, at Unity Point Health, Marshalltown. He was born July 23, 1952, in Waterloo, son of Ralph and Velma Fensel. Dale graduated from Waterloo West High School and Hawkeye Tech. He was a veteran of U.S. Army, serving in the Vietnam War. He was employed in maintenance as a machine operator for Montezuma Manufacturing, Swift, and Meskwaki, retiring in 2009. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, August 21st, at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church, with interment at Mount Olivet Columbarium. Full military rites will be conducted by the Evansdale AMVETS Post 31, assisted by the Iowa Army Honor Guard. Family will receive friends for 1 hour before services at the church. The family asks that friends wear masks if attending the visitation or funeral mass. The mass will be live streamed on BlessedSacramentWaterloo.org and on Facebook. Memorials are directed to the family. Online condolences may be left at www.HaggertyWayWyckoffGryrup.com. Dale enjoyed golf, billiards, computers, poker, and watching television. Diane M. Bonnerman, 65, died August 14, 2020, at home. She was born July 15, 1955, in Washington, Iowa, the daughter of Roger and Juanita Kalachek Schulletter. She graduated from Cedar Falls High School in 1973. Diane married William Bonneman December 23, 1992, in Waterloo. She worked at Allen Hospital, then worked at John Deere for 31 years. She was a member of Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Gilbertville. She loved bowling, fishing, nature, reading, and spending time with her grandchildren. Public visitation is 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 20, 2020. Kearns Funeral Service, Kimball Chapel. A private family service will be held later, with burial at Garden of Memory Cemetery in Waterloo. Go to www.kearnsfuneralservice.com for more information. In lieu of flowers, directed memorials to Cedar Valley Hospice, Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, or Cedar Bend Humane Society. Cedar Falls. Claude Chico Ray Young, 82, of Cedar Falls, died Friday, August 14th, at North Crest Specialty Care. He was born March 9, 1938, in LaPorte City, son of Claude and Blanche Young. He married Mary Jane Woods, and they later divorced. He then married Jeanette Davis, August 28, 1976, in Jessup, and they had one child. Chico served in the United States Marine Corps, came home to LaPorte in 59 from California after the service. He was employed at John Deere in Waterloo and was a member of the local 838 and retired in 94 after over 30 years. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 22nd at Faith Assembly in Evansdale with burial in Gardens of Memories. Public visitation will be Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday at Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service on South Street. Visitation will continue for an hour before services on Saturday. Due to COVID-19, everyone is required to wear a mask at either the visitation or the service. Memorials may be directed to the family. Anyone that knew him knew he was a bit of a wild man. He liked to have fun. He loved his friends, and he had many. He would usually be found camping, mudding in his dune buggy, tinkering on his VW, or scrapping. Anywhere he was, he'd run into someone he knew. He will be missed. George Warren McElrath, Jr., 75, of Bono, Arizona, formerly of Waterloo, died August 15, 2020. He was born January 12, 1945, in Staten Island, New York. George spent most of his life in the Waterloo area. He served in the Air Force from September of 63 through September of 67 in the 788th Squadron. He later retired from the Waterloo Post Office after 33 years of service. He enjoyed outdoor activities, and talking about family history. A celebration of George's life will be arranged at a later date. Waterloo. Margaret A. Whittle, 91, of Waterloo, died Monday, August 17th, at Pinnacle Specialty Care. Mass of Christian burial will be 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, August 25th, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, with burial to follow at Mount Olivet Cemetery. A public visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. at Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Home Funeral Service on South Street, where there will be a 7 o'clock p.m. vigil service. Visitation will continue for 1 hour before the service at the church. For those attending the visitation and or funeral, we ask that you please wear a mask. Memorials may be directed to Sacred Heart Catholic Church or the Northeast Iowa Food Bank. Condolences may be left at www.haggertywyckoffgrarup.com. Donna May Wiley, 87, of Grundy Center, Iowa, and formerly of Conrad, Iowa, and San Benito, Texas, passed away on Saturday, August 15, 2020, at Grundy County Memorial Hospital, while under the care of Cedar Valley Hospice. Visitation and services will be held on Saturday, August 22nd, Engelkiss Abel's Funeral Home in Grundy Center. Visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m., followed by the funeral service at 10:30 a.m. A committal service at Rose Hill Cemetery will be held following the service. Donna was born March 4, 1933, in rural Conrad, the daughter of Menno and Catherine Plunder. She graduated from Conrad High School in 1951. After high school graduation, she completed training at Mercedian School for Practical Nurses at St. Thomas Mercy Hospital in Marshalltown, Iowa. Donna then worked at the Grundy County Memorial Hospital for 2 years. Donna married Vernon Wiley on September 5, 1954. The couple operated Van's Steakhouse in Grundy Center for 2 years and worked together for many years on the farm. They loved going to dances in Janesville on Saturday nights. They also enjoyed trips out west, trips to their fishing cabin in Minnesota, and spending the winter in San Benito, Texas. Vernon died August 15, 1986, and Donna passed away on the 34th anniversary of Vern's death. Donna loved the outdoors, including animals, birds, and flower and vegetable gardens. Whenever the weather was nice, Donna would sit outside enjoying the warm sunshine and the sounds of nature. While she lived at Arlington Place in Grundy Center, she enjoyed participating in the various activities and working on many kinds of craft projects. Lee Baker, age 95, of Hudsonville, Michigan, formerly of Wellsburg, Iowa, went to be with his Lord and Savior on Saturday, August 15, 2020. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, August 20, 2020, at the First Christian Reformed Cemetery in Wellsburg, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to Sunset Legacy Foundation in Jenison, Michigan, Christian High School in Hudsonville, Michigan, or the charity of your choice. Lee served as an elder of Wellsburg CRC and Hillcrest CRC, attending Synod three times. He served on the board of Dort College, on the CRC Denominational Board of Publications, and on the CRC Denominational Home Missions Board. Turning to sports now, United States Hockey League sets target date for return. The United States Hockey League announced Tuesday that it has targeted Friday, November 6th, as the start of the 2020-21 season. Under the plan, teams will play 54 regular season games, with the regular season finale set for April 24th, 2021. Players are scheduled to arrive in market over a four-week period beginning September 14th, with preseason games targeted to begin in mid-October. All activities are designed to take place in accordance with local, state, and federal guidelines, as well as the league's return to play protocols, which are currently being finalized. The regular season schedule allows for flexibility for games to be moved to the back of the schedule due to postponements, capacity restrictions, and other factors. Quote, "We have created a plan to bring players to our markets and in order to safely begin development and ultimately competition," said USHL President and Commissioner Tom Garrity. Quote, "Should conditions change, this plan will allow our league the flexibility to react to new circumstances, and we will adjust accordingly. The plan was formulated in consultation with all USHL member clubs." Quote, "The Blackhawks and our fans are excited to have a target for the organization's most anticipated season in nearly six decades of hockey in the Cedar Valley," the Waterloo franchise noted in a Tuesday release. Many questions are left to be answered about the fan experience at Young Arena, and as an organization, we are just as eager to have those answers as the fans who are asking. Quote, "However, we intend to give thorough and deliberate consideration to all COVID-19 health and safety related issues using all the resources available to us. This will ensure we don't just have answers, but the right answers." In college football, NCAA Mulls Eligibility Mulligan Athletes, filed by Ralph Russo of the Associated Press. And it opens with a photograph with a caption, "UNI running back Trevor Allen is wrapped up by James Madison safety Wayne Davis during a 2019 playoff quarterfinal." Whether college football players play a lot in the fall, a little in the spring, or not at all over the next 10 months, some athletic administrators want to give them a mulligan on the 2020-21 season. The NCAA Division I Council meets Wednesday with two important issues on the agenda. What will happen with the eligibility of fall sport athletes leading into an uncertain season already impacted by the pandemic? And should the NCAA stage fall sports championship events in the spring now that most of Division I has punted on trying to play sports in the first portion of the school year? The council's job is to make a recommendation that the Division I Board of Directors can vote on when it meets Friday. Quote, I think the most forgiving, flexible plan would be the best, Oklahoma Athletic Director Joe Castiglione said of the first question. The council already made one recommendation last week. A year of eligibility and an additional season of competition would be granted to fall sport athletes who opt out of this coming season because of COVID-19 concerns, or if they participate in 50% or less of the maximum number of competitions allowed by the NCAA rules. For a football player, that would be half or fewer of 12 regular season games. Most of the Division I teams still hoping to play this fall have fewer than 12 games scheduled. Meanwhile, four bowl subdivision conferences and all of the championship subdivision have said they won't play in the fall and instead try to have a spring football season. Not a single game is guaranteed because of the pandemic, and athletes are wondering what they should do. Quote, for me and my parents, one of the things we're focusing on is eligibility, said Stanford defensive back Joshua Drayden, who is part of the players' rights group, We Are United. Quote, we're just trying to weigh all our options. Same for a lot of athletes around the Pac-12 in the nation. Because of the uncertainty and so many variables, West Virginia Athletic Director Shane Lyons, who is part of the DI Council, would like to allow athletes in all fall sports to get an extra year of eligibility in competition, regardless of how much they play and win. Quote, we talk about the student-athlete experience, and definitely the season's going to be different. With crowd sizes, the number of competitions, said Lyons, who is also head of the NCAA's Football Oversight Committee. Quote, why charge these student athletes with a year of eligibility? That's one thing they don't have to worry about. As Lyons and others in college sports describe it, the problem for athletes is not just weighing whether to opt out or in at the start of the season. There is concern that a season filled with disruptions will have players who opted in reversing course before reaching the minimum number of games, which would burn a year of eligibility. It also could tempt coaches to hold back players they normally would have played in order to gain that extra year. Lyons said protecting eligibility for all fall athletes seems to be getting momentum among athletic administrators. As for fall championships possibly being held in the spring, Lyons said fields are likely to be cut by as much as 75%, bringing 64 team brackets to 16. The limited space means conferences big and small could decide that holding NCAA championships in sports such as soccer, women's volleyball, and FCS football might not be worth it. Quote, access to championships is really important, Missouri Valley Football Conference Commissioner Patty Verito said. We're going to continue to advocate for as robust an opportunity as we can get in the spring. Public Safety Roundup, Waterloo. One person has been arrested for allegedly shooting a Waterloo man in the face in July. Waterloo police arrested Robert Lee Williams, Jr., 31, of 912 West 6th Street on Monday on charges of willful injury causing serious injury and felon in possession of a firearm. Bond was set at $250,000. The arrest stems from a July 31st shooting where authorities were called to the alley behind the 900 block of West 6th Street around 2:20 p.m. Police and paramedics found Tony Campbell suffering from a gunshot wound to the face and took him to a hospital for treatment. Investigators located security videos that recorded the incident, and the footage shows Campbell and Williams pulling into the alley in a white car, according to court records. They exited when a third person arrived. The video shows Williams pulled out a gun while they were talking and pointed it at Campbell's face, according to court records. When Campbell tried to bat away the weapon, Williams fired, records state. At the time of the shooting, Williams was out on bond for allegedly waving around a gun a few days earlier. In that case, residents reported people in a passing vehicle displaying gang signs and pointing guns in the 1200 block of Franklin Street around 2:16 p.m. July 26th. Officers stopped the vehicle in the 300 block of Monroe Street and found a 9mm pistol. Williams, who was a passenger, was arrested for felon and domestic abuser in possession of a firearm. Gunshots strike house, auto. Waterloo. Waterloo police are investigating a Tuesday morning shooting that damaged a home and a parked car. No injuries were reported, and police said it appeared the house and vehicle weren't the targets and had been hit by stray bullets. Neighbors called 911 around 12:50 a.m. Tuesday after hearing gunfire in the 900 block of Logan Avenue. Police found the damage and spent shell casings in the area. Iowa State audit finds evidence of malfeasance in Cloutier. Des Moines. A special investigation into concerns of malfeasance in the east central city of Cloutier turned up more than $100,000 in improper and unsupported spending of public money and undeposited collections, state officials said. State Auditor Rob Sand said in a new report that the audit looked at the handling of city finances by former city clerk Kerry Kopriva from 2015 through the beginning of 2019. The investigation found $64,530 in improper disbursements, $9,209 in unsupported disbursements, and $43,450 in undeposited utility collections. The report found much of the misspending included direct payments to Kopriva and unauthorized purchases on the city's credit card. The more than $43,000 in undeposited utility collections is an estimate garnered by comparing the average cash utility collections deposited during Kopriva's tenure to the average deposited after her employment, Sand said. Copies of the report were filed with the Tama County Sheriff's Office, the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, the Tama County Attorney's Office, and the Iowa Attorney General's Office, Sand said. Waterloo Movie Theater reopens Friday with social distancing guidelines, filed by Kristen Guess. And the article opens up with a photograph of a self-service ticket kiosk with social distancing markings on the floor and self-service computer terminals on the counter. Waterloo, film lovers longing for the full movie theater experience are in luck. Marcus Theaters Crossroads Cinema will open Friday in Waterloo. Doors will open at noon with screenings of some new releases, recent releases, and classic fare. Concession stands will be open, but booth tickets and food can be purchased remotely, part of the many updated health and safety measures instituted to keep patrons safe. Online ticket ordering will be available for those who prefer less contact. Masks will be required, except when eating or drinking. And hand sanitizer will be available throughout the complex. The safety and well-being of our guests and associates will always be our top priorities, said Rolando Rodriguez, chairman, president, and CEO of Marcus Theaters, in a press release. Guests will be greeted by the Marcus Theaters Movie Star approach, which incorporates updated health and safety measures in alignment with the CDC guidelines. Social distancing throughout, cleaning, app and website ordering of tickets, food, and concessions for no to low contact interactions, and respecting each other by following these new protocols. Along with Waterloo, 35 of 91 Marcus Theater locations will reopen Friday, and on August 28, about 30 more locations will reopen. The remaining theaters, including the Cedar Falls College Square Cinema, will open at a later date. 6 of the company's theaters currently are open. As theaters reopen, there initially will be a mix of classic content and new movie releases, including Unhinged, a special 10-year anniversary release of Inception, and Words on Bathroom Walls on Friday, The New Mutants and the Personal History of David Copperfield on August 28th, and Tenet for Labor Day weekend. Auditorium capacities will be reduced, and there will be 2 empty seats between groups for proper social distancing. Showtimes will be staggered to allow a limited number of customers in each theater at a time. Reserved seating will allow groups to sit together. Cash will be accepted, but contactless payments such as credit and debit cards is encouraged. You can purchase tickets at the box office or order in advance on the Marcus Theaters app or at marcustheaters.com. Upon arrival, pre-purchase tickets will be distributed through a ticket ripper stand. Box offices will be open with plexiglass. Popcorn, soda, and candy will be available. Food orders may be placed before arriving at the theater and received at the designated pickup area. Concession stands will be open for those who prefer to order on site. Marcus will be showing movies that were popular when theaters closed, such as Sonic the Hedgehog, Bad Boys for Life, and Jumanji, The Next Level. Retro classics will also be shown. Tickets will cost $5 and will return to standard pricing as new movies are released. For more information, go to www.marcustheaters.com/reopening. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Wednesday, August 19th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks so much for listening today.